Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome everybody to season 3 episode 15. I can't believe we're already here. Of Psychologists Are In. I'm Maggie Lawson.
And I'm her podcast partner in crime, Timothy Albertson.
And we are so lucky today to have the writer, director, and of course lead actor of this episode, Mr. James Roday Rodriguez. Together, we talk about the silliest Friday the 13th spoof, Tuesday the 17th. Enjoy, you guys.
What's up, team?
I love this hat.
Yeah, let me tell you something. I'm not a straight build hat guy per se. I feel like it's probably a little bit beyond my fashion reach. But what happens is I get these boxes of swag from the Spurs and the Titans every year. And for whatever reason, both of these franchises have decided to go straight brim.
Interesting.
I'd be interested to see the results of a straw poll where we let like 30 people weigh in. I don't know if it goes my way.
Joms, hi.
What's happening, you two?
Joms is here. Hi, Tim.
Hey, Maggie.
For those of you listening who have not signed up for the Patreon,
yeah,
if you sign up for the Patreon, you get to visually see how amazing Maggie looks and how fiercely handsome James is with his awesome beard and corduroy Tennessee Titans hat.
That's right.
Tim, you look great today too.
You look very, very handsome.
Like
I did show up a little early and realized I might get the time wrong, so I had an extra half an hour to put more mustache wax in.
Thank you for joining us for this very, very special. This is like all you. This episode is so purely James Rodriguez on every from all of it. And I was just going back and thinking, like, gosh, how it must have felt to you, because you have, I mean, now you've gone on to direct so many things, and you're this was like a big first time,
it was huge. I can't believe we're up to this episode already. What does that mean that you've done, how many have you done now then? Four. So you've done like over 40 of these.
Yeah.
So you're pros now.
Oh, we have our things. It was funny. Steve was so nervous. It was very cute. Not nervous, but he just was like, Tim was away. And so I asked Steve if he'd want to come on and like co-host. He was so excited and he was so funny and so good. So Tim does this thing where he can label a color. Like he's our wardrobe specialist.
His Crayola color was freaking spot on.
It was Halloween 3 Season of the Witch Silver Shamrock Pumpkin Mask Orange was so the good name that someone was wearing. It was so good. But anyway, Tuesday the 17th.
And it was full of, that episode was chock full of insider insights from the man himself.
Yeah, yes, it was.
So James, before we dig in and just podcast the shit out of this with your assist, just want to say that this is the episode so special to me on so many reasons. One, not the least, which is, I mean, you obviously became one of my, close your ears, Steve, favorite directors very quickly. This is the one where I fell in love with you as a director. I was already in love with you as an actor and a friend. But then as a director with your directorial debut, holy shit, man, did you pull out all the stops.
It's nuts. You directed the shit out of
it. Yeah, well, there was a lot of buildup. You know, I felt like I was chomping at the bit. I knew it was coming for like a solid year. So I had plenty of time to stack the deck in my favor. I also, of course, had the full support of our crew. You all were wonderful. I can't imagine how badly I would have needed to shit the bed in order for that episode to not be a success, because nobody was going to let me fall. And I felt that from the moment I started prepping all the way till we wrapped.
So did you Steve co-wrote this, didn't he? I know he wrote parts of it, right?
Yeah, we co-wrote this one. The rule, there's so few rules on our show with regards to anything, but as far as me directing, the only rule was that Steve got to go first. So when Steve directed at the end of season two, like the door was open and I knew it would be season three. And initially we had talked about writing a Hitchcock episode for me to direct, which I was super stoked about, obviously. As we got into season three and, you know, and we're on set and I, you know, I have no days off, it started to feel like maybe we were being too ambitious and that we would push off the Hitchcock idea maybe to a future season. I'm so glad we did, because not only were we able to do Hitchcock, we were able to tie it into the Yang trilogy, which was sort of perfect. So once we decided it wasn't going to be Hitchcock, and a big part of that was that both of us just, we really wanted to set me up to succeed. Steve was like, what do you want to do? Like, what do you think you could honestly sort of like direct in your sleep? And I said, a slasher movie. Like I've seen more slasher movies than any other thing that someone could see in any medium. And he said, great, do it. Let's do it. So once I got the green light on that, I knew I was probably going to be in pretty good shape, because I was stealing from films that I knew most people had never seen or even heard of. And even when it came like to shot listing, like so many shots in that episode are winking at, you know, moments from other movies.
It's, but was there anything from Chopping Mall?
It was sort of a love. Listen to last week. Letter.
Remember Steve's reference to Chopping Mall?
I mean, yes, of course. And I know, and you're always so generous around, you know, thanking the crew and everything else. But this was so purely you. Like, nobody had the whole opening, like rewatching it. Like, I remember, it's just been a long time since I've seen it, but just rewatching, yeah, like so many of these kind of classic horror, but like they're not just, it's not like, oh yeah, yeah, this is kind of horror-y. It's like spot on, really, the whole darkness, the whole opening with Annie and the, I mean, all the frights and the tea kettle and the phone and how all, it's just, it's so good. I not that I forgot. It has just been a long time since I've seen it. And I was like, this is so, nobody else, I don't think being a comedy and everything, this is so purely your world. So you-
Actually,
you,
Nora you, wanted to watch Miss Sort of Halloween-y last night and we couldn't really pick on land on something. So I almost suggested, let's watch Tuesday the 17th.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I remember that teaser was the first cut of it was a little too intense for everybody, which actually I was pretty pleased about.
Of course.
Do you remember anything that was like, yeah, you got to cut that?
I think it was just sort of like dynamically, it was almost completely devoid of levity. So it really like... Oh. The endeavor was to make it play like a real slasher movie, like cold open. And it was, and for our show, especially up to that point, we were only in season three. Like we hadn't really done that, where we didn't sort of like, even if we did something spooky, we would immediately tell you that it was okay by making a ridiculous joke or having Sean and Gus run away screaming or whatever. It was always like, don't worry. It's not too scary. And I was like, let's not do that. Let's just go for it and treat it like a real horror movie teaser. And everybody was into it. I just remember like studio network, everybody was like, maybe we just pull it back a little bit.
I love that though. I'm with you. That's such a good place to to start.
It's not like Scary Sherry where there's a head rolling down the to the foot of the stairs.
I had learned a lesson or two in the interim, but I still felt like, you know, I wanted from the moment that teaser ended, I wanted everybody to have an idea of what they were in store for.
Mm-hmm.
Which
it
is why
it sets the tone. Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't want to pull punches. That was our old pal, Sonya Bennett.
In that
teaser.
She was so good.
Yeah.
Everybody is so good in the episode. That was the other thing. I'm like, oh, and Louisa and Eldon and Scott, everybody's fantastic. You know, you, I feel like, you know, wasn't your first day Tim?
Yeah. Well,
okay.
We did.
Oh, I was going to talk about that. Was your first day shooting, right?
First day shooting, first day directing, first day.
And you set up one of the most complicated shots possible, which I'll get into when we get to that scene.
Okay. That
I got to warn you, everybody, I'm coming in hot with this episode.
Are you?
I'm chomping at the bit too. I am. I've already, in the teaser, I've already got a stat degree of separation.
Oh, should we go? Let's go. Let's jump in. But as I was thinking about it today, like, I feel like this, I mean, it was, this was 2009? Is that when this was? Season three?
It was like, the aughts.
This is crazy. And it's 2022. And this was your first time directing.
Yeah, this was the one that kicked it all off.
Yeah.
In the most perfect way. I mean, I got to make a little mini slasher movie with all my friends and didn't have to raise the money for it. It was pretty fantastic. And I guess also, again, I always go back to Steve and just how generous he was in terms of letting me do things to this show.
Yeah.
And this is yet another example of him gifting me the opportunity to go make a thing that he knew I was excited about and that
and he knew you would kick the shit out of.
Yeah, and I think it gave him confidence as well that, you know, this I would be able to land it, but still, I mean, we weren't that far removed from, you know, the tennis episode or whatever the kind of stuff we were doing in season one. Like it's still quite a departure. And he was always willing to go there.
Unreal.
This is not a super episode.
It's unreal.
It's not an unambitious episode of television to shoot. I mean, you were making a slasher film in 58 minutes.
Yeah.
It's legit. What was it? Do you have any? Oh, yeah, go on.
And you know, there aren't that many elements that you need to nail to make an effective slasher. But one of them is sort of the anatomy of a kill scene. And you can't rush it. You got to set up the sense of dread. You have to have some sort of false scare that lets you take your guard down for a second. And then you got to come in with the kill.
Was there like one thing where you were like, man, I hope I can pull this off? Like, because I feel like you were excited, but also pretty confident. Like this is your world. You kind of like, you knew what you wanted to do.
I wasn't really worried about any of the slasher stuff. I think if anything, if I had any anxiety at all, it was about the B story. It was about Lassiter and his ex-wife, just because we had set that up for 2.5 seasons, you know, and I felt like, you know, landing that was really important to Lassiter's character. But the idea was always to have Lassiter turn a baby corner, like a first real legit, like if you look back and map out the course of Lassiter, like you got to go to this episode to see, like, oh, we saw a different piece of him in that episode. So
that's in my first from my professional notes.
Oh, really?
It is. So before we get into the nitty gritty, opening shot is a psych degree of separation for Margaret Cassidy Lawson. Opening shot is of it's the wrong color, but it's a Woody station wagon.
Oh,
not
God.
Like the Woody
that's
that
so true.
Your family drove you from Kentucky to LA.
Kentucky, yeah.
What year did you come out?
97.
Okay,
97.
So this was in 88.
This was This was in 1988. That's what we had. So my grandfather had a 1988 Woody station wagon. We didn't own a car. So my grandparents gave us this car, their car, basically, to drive to Los Angeles in 1997 in a 1988 Woody station wagon. It was just perfect. And in fact, that was my first car. I was like driving to auditions, like my little self, just like driving to my auditions at like 17, 18, 19 years old in a Woody station wagon.
Instagram, that one was white. The one in Psych is green.
Yes. Yes.
But still, yeah, the one I thought was pretty solid psych degree of separation.
No, I like that one a lot, Tim. That was a that's a very, very sweet one. That's a very full circle-y thing. All right. Oh God, I loved this location so much.
Yeah, and
where was this?
It was a
Libertine up north.
Right?
It was an actual camp that was about to be torn down. And I remember we paid a little extra for them to push the demolition. We were like, please let us shoot here before you rip everything down.
Mm-hmm.
I have a double pineapple sighting within seconds of each other.
Oh, uh-huh. Well, yeah, because isn't it in the beginning?
Yeah, it's the pinata.
The pinata.
Pineapple pinata. Fade to once Henry's truck pulls away with the boys, we see a teepee and a Native American holding a pineapple in their hands.
I missed that one. I totally missed that one. Wait, oh my God, really?
I had a week off, man. I had time to really hone my co-hosting skills.
And then I feel like we threw another one in in the refrigerator, too.
There's one in the fridge.
Loaded it up on that one.
So on the synopsis, it's very cute. So Devin put episode 15, Tuesday the 17th, written by Joms and Steve, directed by Joms, who is James Rene Rodriguez, nicknamed Joms. That is very cute, Devin. So, okay, we got the pineapple sightings out of the way. Shall we jump in and throw in all gooey goodness, pineapple goodness, you remember from the episode or anything that you remember memory-wise. Oh, wait, Tim, are you ready to podcast the shit out of it?
Maggie, I am so ready to podcast the shit out of this. I had a week off, listened to last week's episode, so brilliantly co-hosted by Steve, got really sad that I couldn't be part of it, but was so grateful that he stepped into my shoes while I was gallivanting across England.
Gallivanting!
Possibly drinking. Mm-hmm. Most likely
I see what you did there. Everybody does.
Gallivanting.
It's on Hulu, by the way.
I got to tell you, Jobs, he had the trip. If you can imagine, you'll get this. Like, he went to London. He hasn't been since before that thing that happened that was in all the papers that apparently I need to be reminded of all the time. Do you want to let James know what that is? Oh, he had a stroke. Correct. So before then...
Am I okay?
Huh?
Am I okay?
You're more than okay. I forget. You have to remind me.
You got handsomer somehow.
I know.
Which almost doesn't seem fair to the rest of us.
So it's his favorite place in the world, his favorite bars in the world. And he got to go back for the first time and have the entire... I think you kind of did everything you wanted to do while you were there. I mean, I started photos from Duke's and your favorite pub and your favorite restaurant. Yeah.
And went with my best friend, Nick Schwartz, from the random last yelling out of Schwartz. Discovered that here's something that's amazing about London. One of the many things. London black cabs all have wheelchair ramps that they can either pull out or... So Nick would, and they're kind of like minivans, they're already huge vehicles. So Nick would just wheel me into these things. We'd bop around town. And double-decker buses also have ramps that they pull out.
Insane.
So I could wheel into those. And then they're so good about disability over there. To get up to the top of double-decker bus, handrails everywhere. So Nick and I went on a sightseeing tour, railed up, was able to walk up the stairs to the upper deck. Taking the sights. It was pretty amazing.
Well, rock on, London.
Yeah. As your friend, I was, every single photo you sent me, I was just like, yes, Tim's, he's doing it. He was doing it. Anyway, it was very, very heartwarming. And Tim, you should post some of those pictures. They were so good. You look so happy. All right. Pineapple sighting. We did. Let's go, guys. Ready? Cold open, 1988. Yongshan and Gus are being picked up from summer camp at Camp Tikihama. Young Sean is furious with Gus because he ditched him for Golden Boy Jason Cunningham in the pinata competition, leaving Sean to team up with the kid who wore the jacket the entire time. One of my favorite jokes of the whole script. The kid who
it's
wore
a million degrees.
The puffy on jacket the whole time. Okay, cut to a very creepy zoom in on a canoe and Sean's sunken pinata chained to a rock. Ugh. It was very creepy. Very creepy. How'd you shoot that?
And we did some underwater photography.
Who went underwater?
We brought in an operator who sort of specialized and had his own equipment, I remember. And we did that. We shot that in a little in a pool, like an above ground.
Yeah.
I guess you could call it a tank, but it was really small. And we did it right there on our lot. They come and they fill it with water and who knew that we could make the bottom of a lake look so real?
It was very real and very creepy. And there is a psych out from this that is not on Peacock that I know the psychos will, I'm sure, post that.
When the pinata comes out and gets, who does it get? Is it you?
No, it's Gus. It's Dulé.
Oh, it's Gus, of course.
Yeah. He's just like in the lake. Remember, it's like super serene. Yeah, that's very good. All right. 20 years later, Annie, a camp counselor, sits in her cabin on a stormy night watching a horror movie alone. She hears a noise and investigates, but discovers it was just an open window. Hang on.
Creepy.
She then looks at... I know. It's good. This was so good. She then looks out the window and sees a mysterious figure with a sack over his head standing across the lake. But she just thinks her eyes are playing tricks on her. She picks up a phone call, only to have the mysterious figure peering in from the window. Annie pours herself some tea, opens the refrigerator, and sees a note written in blood which reads, "I see you." As
James,
Annie frighteningly backs up.
What's the tea kettle shot from?
Yeah.
He knows you're alone. And then it's been redone a bunch of times, but it's in a lot of Babysitter and Peril ripoffs.
Good.
I love that song. That's The Cure, right?
Yeah.
So good. As Annie frighteningly backs up, the man from earlier bursts through the window and attacks her just moments before the opening credits. This was also perfect because you had this super opening, a super scary opener, and then Tuesday, there he is.
There he is.
Hi, Claude.
Claude.
We love you. Mm. Oh, gosh, what a good boy. The Tuesday the 17th, just like Friday the 13th comes up, and it's already, you've already set the perfect tone of like, this was really scary, and like, oh, but it's still psych. It's still psych. Tuesday the 17th still cracks me up. It's always right after Friday the 13th.
It always is. And there was, Richard Benjamin made a movie called Saturday the 14th in the 80s. That was not just a spoof of slasher. It was just sort of a spoof of horror.
Okay.
Very, very silly movie. So Saturday the 14th was not on the table.
No.
And then it just came down to what sounds the funniest. Sunday the 15th, Monday the 16th, Tuesday the 17th is ridiculous. So
it's completely ridiculous.
It's good. 4 full days too. It's like, you know, it's not that close to Friday anymore.
Well, as a little personal insight, next Tuesday, the 18th, Allison, my 25th wedding anniversary. So I was watching Tuesday the 17th and went, oh, that's really close.
Oh, that's really sweet. You all had much better luck than you and Victoria.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true.
Yes. Okay, back at the psych office, Sean and Gus argue about lettuce. Very funny, by the way. This was just a great, like, if you catch it, it's so good. And you're like, no, it just takes over. Anyway. And,
you know, that was Steve Franks. Anything, any kind of food humor or any jokes involving a burrito is vintage.
Steve?
Vintage Steve. Vintage Steve Franks.
So good. All right. Sean and Gus argue about lettuce. They happen to find Sean's old Rick Astley pinata hanging outside and his mortal enemy, Jason Cunningham. Yes, Devin. Jason reveals he bought Camp Tikihama and that he needs their help finding a missing counselor.
Hold on. I just got to say, by the way, we got to shout out Mac.
Yeah, the casting of Jason. By the way, Jason is, of course, a nod to Jason Voorhees, and Cunningham is a nod to Sean S. Cunningham, who directed the first Friday the 13th. So those are pretty obvious.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I totally missed the Jason.
It wasn't
so
obvious to me, but okay, got it.
but there was a big question of like, who's going to play Jason? Because, you know, he got to have a lot of fun. He sort of got to play two characters for the, you know, for the price of one.
Yeah.
And it was going to be a good time, but we also, you know, again, Steve was like, I want you to be surrounded by people that you trust and that you have a shorthand with. So basically whoever you want.
Amazing.
And I had known sweet, sweet Mac for years.
Give the full name.
Mackenzie Aston. One of the sweetest fellas with the biggest hearts that you'll ever come across in our business or any other business. And we had worked together very briefly on a short-lived series some years before, but then stayed pals and played softball together every Thursday and Sunday for years. And so I knew he would come in. I knew he would crush it. I knew he would be warm and wonderful to everybody. And I knew he would be happy to get on a plane and come to Vancouver. So that one did not take long to come up with.
He's so kind. He is just such a kind person. Now, did Eldon, did you know Eldon? I had known Eldon from years before, but I didn't know if you did.
Eldon was another important piece of casting because, you know, he, spoiler alert, he turns out to be the killer, and we did not want anyone to see that coming.
Right.
We specifically sort of framed that character within the slasher archetype of, you know, the comic relief guy or the stoner.
Yeah.
And the person that usually dies pretty quick.
Yeah.
So that, again, to sort of throw off the scent as much as we could. And a lot of people read for that role, and I wasn't quite sold. And it was a Maggie Lawson pitch that we go after Eldon. And
I couldn't remember if I mentioned him or if that was like,
Eldon.
Yeah.
I said, I love Eldon. I love that idea.
Yeah.
And so I want to say we plucked him off a mountain he was on vacation somewhere, and I remember the agent was like, I don't even know if I'll be able to get a hold of Eldon. And not only did we get a hold of him, I think he cut his trip short to come up and play with us, which is so very cool of him, and he's fantastic in it as well.
So a little tip for young actress regarding this casting with Mackenzie: it pays to don't be an a-hole, so you make friends with people who then hire you later. And always, if you're on vacation, check your messages from your agent.
Yes, yes, exactly. Have a way that they can still reach you, because you never know. By the way, it is kind of this, it's almost like a rule, I think, that we all know. It's like the second you're like on a trip somewhere, that's when you get a job.
Always.
Like, people know this, yeah.
Want a job, book a non-refundable airline ticket.
Yes, yes, always, always. Sometimes I'll be like, you know, it's been a while. Maybe I should just take a trip. Maybe that'll make... Yeah. All right. So Jason reveals about the camp, da-da-da. Oh, right, but do not get the cops involved. Big, very important thing, he says. Back at the station, Lassiter generously gives Chief Vic some flowers along with boxes of chocolates because he's having a special date later that night with his ex-wife. He went overboard trying to find the perfect gift and gave Chief Vic all the no-goes. So can we just, you're so sweet and vulnerable. It's from the very beginning in this, Tim, like I was like already tearing up watching you. I mean, I know how it ends, but I was like, yeah, also you look fantastic.
Oh yeah.
Like
by far the most important thing. So
I know,
thank you for that.
I know.
Matinee idol, 100%.
Very, very much.
I had never gotten to play anything like this before, so it was an incredible gift you and Steve gave me, Jamas.
The impetus was to watch Lassiter open himself up in a way that we hadn't seen before. And obviously, you know, what's so heartbreaking about it is that he goes there and it's not requited. But just for him to get to a place where he sort of like, you know, said I'm going for this was brand new ground, and it was very, very exciting to get to watch you play that. We knew that you would absolutely destroy it, and that you had more than earned this type of material after, you know, three seasons of Wile E. Coyote-ing it. we were both so excited about this B story, because you were so, like, you're obviously such a wonderful actor. You have so many layers to you, and this was our chance to sort of let you shine, as we knew that you could.
Now, and is, also, like I said, this is some of the greatest stuff, not prior to, but since. I don't think I've had hardly anything as juicy and good as this and emotional as this, romantically, mm-hmm. to play.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe just a little bit in that other show I did after this one.
Yes.
Starts with a G, but.
And but, you know, this was setting feel, me up. We just wanted it to feel real, you know?
Yeah.
Like, Psych is such a silly show, and the balance was generally, you know, 90% silly and 10% grounded. So in a way, this was a big swing for us.
Yeah.
Like dedicating an entire B story to just two people talking about real stuff and being honest and being vulnerable and ultimately getting crushed.
You know, I love my matcha lattes. It's just kind of my thing. I drink them on my walks. I drink them on set, off set, even during the podcast. Literally, I am drinking one as we speak. I love them so much. So you can imagine the excitement I had when I found a healthy alternative to those sugar-laden creamers. Thankfully, I discovered Lechia's organic macadamia and chia and flax milk. Now, I know what you're thinking. Macadamia nut milk? I mean, didn't we just become obsessed with oat milk? I did. I became obsessed with oat milk. But I am stopping you there, because macadamia nut milk is the new trend of 2022. I am calling it. Most plant-based milk is full of sugar. It provides no nutritional benefit. But I love Lechia's milk because it has 0 grams of sugar. And it is rich in those brain and heart-healthy omega-3s. And it is so yummy. And it also provides prebiotics for healthy digestion. You guys, the best part? Lechia, also gluten-free. Those of you who have celiac, like myself. Lechia is available on Amazon. So nice, so convenient. For you psychos, at a discount, go to amazon.com and use code 25pineapple for a 25% discount on all Lechia products. That's 25% off, you guys. That's no joke. That's amazon.com and use code 25pineapple at checkout to get a 25% discount. Enjoy those lattes, you guys. I know I am right now. Sean, okay, I'm going to move on. Sean and Gus agree to help Jason return to Camp Takehama, only to be stopped by the creepiest man declaring, "You're all doomed." Very good.
Yes, that is, again, unapologetic, zero-veiled wink at the character of Ralph from Friday the 13th, Part 1 and 2.
Yeah.
Same exact, he serves the same purpose. He almost says the exact same dialogue.
So good. It's so good.
Oh, sorry, I love Dulé's, like, to convince you, for the children, the kids.
Oh, it's so good. Okay, at camp, they meet Clive. And by the way, okay, we've got Clive, Billy, and Sissy, as well as Jason in a possessed-like state. Was Clive named after Clive?
Clive was a thank you wink to Clive Barker, another master of horror writer, director, who gave us the Books of Blood, which is what Hellraiser came from.
So it's so funny because didn't we work with a Clive? Wasn't there a Clive? Didn't we have a Clive the first or second season of Psych? That's what made me think of it. That didn't we go gun training with him?
Oh, Clive was our Clive. Season one early prop master.
Remember Clive? Yeah.
Yes, you're right. Holy.
And I was like, oh, yeah.
He was our prop master, who then sort of became our default armorer.
Yeah.
Before we got the amazing Rob Fournier.
Yeah.
So you and I, that was the infamous Maggie going way too fast to gun training out.
That was also the infamous, like, there are lots of guns here.
Yeah.
At this gun training place, there was lots of guns. But yes, we've told this story on here before, my speeding ticket in Chilliwack. All right.
Chilliwack, that's where it was.
So I could tell you, Annie is the first victim in Friday the 13th. She's the one who hitchhikes and never actually makes it to the camp. So that's why we had an Annie. Sissy is a character from Friday the 13th part 6. I just think it's a fun name, but she was also a victim.
So funny.
I believe she ends up with a noise. Annie gets her throat slit. Sissy takes like a something to her eye. And then I think gets thrown through a window just to add insult to injury. Clive was for Clive Barker. Jason, obviously, for Jason. And then what was it? Billy. I think Billy was just like, we wanted the most all-American beefcake name we could think of.
Yeah. He's so good.
Not Tim.
All these people.
Besides Tim.
Timmy. Okay, so Sean, Gus, and Sissy check out Annie's home in the laundry room where they find Annie's blood-soaked PJs in the washing machine. Yes, Tim.
If we're in the laundry room, I think we have a show first.
What?
I think it's the show first. Let's twist this.
Oh. Yes! I wrote that down in all caps. That's right.
A catchphrase was born.
A catchphrase psych first. These are our, we've labeled things now. Joms, we have, I have let's twist this in all caps. Fearless Guster. Oh God, this is so funny. So hold on. we have like psychonic, we say now, we have our psych first of things that happen that are like, what? That's a big psych first actually, because let's twist this became like major. I feel
it was
like really major
because it wasn't said by a regular of our cast.
It was a
supporting character who didn't even live through the episode who managed to coin a phrase that really stuck.
But he also we're not to the scene yet, but he also gets naked. This guy went through a lot for us. He really did. Anyway, I think he was fine with it. But okay. Sean, Gus, and Sissy. Okay, we did that. After gathering Clive and Billy, they all go out and search for Annie, except for Sean, who stays behind and calls Juliet to come help them. Gus and Sissy walk around the woods together, and Gus tries to show off. I had to pause. I was laughing so hard at Fearless Guster and him throwing the shovel willy-nilly.
Which, I got to say, his reading of They Call Me, it was almost a dead-on They Call Me Mr. Tibbs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
It was like right to the edge of Poitiers and then pulls it back.
Oh, so good. Okay. Billy falls into a trap. In the woods, only to have the potato sack mystery man stand behind him with an axe. Back at Santa Barbara, Lassie arrives hours early before his date begins, only to find his ex-wife there as well. I want to give a shout out to Gerard's.
I missed that. So dumb. Gerard's, of course, are the Sun Place bar, home away from home.
Yeah. What were you going
to
say, Tim?
When Lassie shows up to that date with Victoria.
Yeah.
He is wearing his full sternbush.
Yes.
Like he's almost down to like the third button is almost open.
Oh yeah. So, he was going for it, man. He was leaving it all on the table.
Then James, prior to this scene, you and I of course had dinner at Joe Forte's with our guest star Justine Bateman.
That's right.
For a little get to know each other
and to give her a little bit of a background about this character that we had heard about but had never seen. For all these seasons, and so that the two of you could actually meet and talk a little bit before showing up on set, because we knew it was going to be a big day. We basically shot the entire B story in one day,
and it was your first day.
And it was my first day, so I wanted to sort of stack the deck as much as possible.
There's a lot writing emotionally from me and my character on this on this day we were about to shoot the next day.
Yeah.
There were a few glasses of oaky wine.
Yes, there were. There were.
Oh, really?
I remember Justine was not having
an off-camera story.
Not having the wine that was being delivered. And I'm not a wine drinker, so I couldn't tell you if it was good or not. But but that was also a very important piece of casting, obviously.
Yeah.
Really, really wanted to get it right. Also, it was as we all know, site casting in many ways was sort of a flashback to actors and actresses that populated our TV screens and our dreams of someday doing what we do when we were younger. And Justine Bateman absolutely 100% fits that bill and checks
those boxes. How do we got Mallory, for goodness sakes?
We got Mallory Keaton to come up and play Victoria. So we were all pretty stoked about that as well.
Yeah. Okay, once Juliet arrives at the camp, she finds Sean hiding in the closet. This was one of my favorite scenes to shoot.
Hang on, you're
in the whole
series. You can't
just
roll past that, Max.
Wait, what? Why?
You're in burnt pomegranate. Which, of course, is still in the Pepto drink family. So drink up, everybody. And
did you see that somebody, did you see the thing someone posted where they were like, we were at the doctor's office and they were like, suggesting a medicine, and they were like, oh, this is like Tim and Maggie's. Yeah,
it's a childhood antibiotic, because Nuri used to get sinus infections all the time. So there was a lot of that one particular antibiotic in our house.
So good.
It was the Pepto Pink that the kid had to drink.
So it's not
I'm
just
assuming
pomegranate.
They didn't spike it. And also, you had another 6 degrees. Early on, when you got this job, you commented about how at first playing a detective, you kind of felt like you were a kid wearing your dad's suit.
I did.
This suit is like five sizes too big for you, the one you're wearing. So it was full circle. It looked like you were actually wearing your dad's suit.
I think there were that, like, the suits did get a bit more tailored over the years, but it's funny in this one. I kind of like, I think because I'm playing, I'm actually in like tough. Like I go full cop mode in this. I don't mind it as much. Like, I think that would stand out to me probably in like other scenes where I'm just being, you know, Juliet in the station or something. But there was something about this suit that actually felt a bit more uniform-y to me. That
it was also
like
a light gray linen, which made no sense. Like you're in this super
in the
fall colored blouse.
Yeah.
And in a suit for the Hamptons.
I just was like, there were a couple times where I'm running or whatever, and I'm like, this feels like a cop suit. It felt to me, it was not for fashion, but it was definitely like it fit where I loved this so much, James, because I got to come play with in the camp, which I really wanted to do, but also, you know, I'm kind of like lead on this. I get stuck there and I get to kind of have I get to be in charge a little bit, which was,
Yeah,
no, you say today. There's no Lassiter taking over. This is all O'Hara.
Yeah.
We sort of flipped Lassie and Juliet in this episode where, you know, Juliet gets to kind of be tough and full cop mode while Lassiter
is soft and sweet.
Is soft and sticky. Yeah.
Vulnerable.
It was a fun little reversal of roles.
Okay. Meanwhile, Lassiter gives his ex-wife a necklace only to discover that the reason they wanted to get together.
Okay. So the scene with, Victoria.
Uh-huh.
First day of James being a director, and he sets up, as I mentioned earlier, one of the most complicated shots possible. I remember showing up to set and you had this, they were laying circular track, which is crazy to try and shoot. So
yeah, we did a 360 around that table. I think it's actually become something of a cliche for first time directors who think they're doing something, you know, that's never been done before. To the point now that I think it comes out of DP's mouths before the director can even get it out. Hey, I was thinking you want to do a 360. You know, like but for the purposes of this scene specifically, I thought that the choice actually supported the material. I mean, the idea was that had put it all on the line, was pretty nervy, and then starts to sort of spin out a little bit as he realizes that the evening is not going to go the way that he thought it was going to go. So
it's like a literal spin out.
Yeah, that's why I figured it was worth it, and that, you know, we could justify doing it.
I just remember watching them setting up that track, thinking this dude's out of his freaking mind to shoot his first day with a circular track.
But he knew. That was the thing I remember. Like, you know, first-time director, I think you can sometimes feel the first-timiness of it, and you want to kind of almost help. I feel like everyone in your hands felt very like, all right, like, he's got this. Like, he's got us. Like, there were some shots, even I remember being like, what? how are we going to get that? How is he doing that? Even at the end when the reveal, like of the three of us and the language we're not to yet, but like some of these shots were insane and you nailed them.
Well,
like,
that's very kind.
But like emotionally, I wrote down the circle table in my notes, just like, this is so beautiful.
I will say, I remember this like it was yesterday. When Sean is in the hiding in the closet like a coward in the laundry room and Juliet shows up, I was in there with Marco Ciccone, shout out.
Marco Ciccone.
I was there to give you your off-camera dialogue from inside the closet, but I was watching through his camera also to see the shot. And remember, this was before we switched to digital. We were still shooting on film. And there was this tiny hole that we had not made in the door. And Juliet walks into the laundry room, hits her mark, and you can see her face.
Through the thing, yeah.
Through the door that we didn't plan that. And so Marco and I both like started getting like jiggly with excitement and had to sort of calm ourselves so that it didn't ruin the shot, because it was
synchronistic.
It was
that hole in the door was there.
100% Can't How take an cool. ounce of credit for that. Just happened to fall that way.
What a beautiful shot though.
It was very cool.
Yeah. All right. So let's see. Sean's hiding in the closet. Okay, Lassiter gives his ex-wife a necklace. Yes. Yes.
I gotta give a shout out to Mr. Franks. The that goodbye speech that Lassiter gives, that incredible speech.
Oh, yeah.
I always thought James wrote it because I just saw James' name on the credit, on the writing credit. Little did I know, after shouting James out about the speech at our first Comic-Con, did I find out that Steve actually wrote all that stuff. Am I correct in that?
He certainly had his hands way, way, way in that. In that Lassiter speech.
It's so, so good. Well, hold on, because I want to shout out something else in that scene too. In a moment. Okay, so Lassiter gives her a necklace and she hits him with divorce papers. While Sean goes to look for Jason, he finds Annie's dead, strangled body and the potato sack guy, who then chases after Sean. Sean trips and falls, but the sack-faced mystery man doesn't kill him because it's actually Jason! Or wait, are we at Annie, are you okay? Yet?
I think Annie, you're okay is what happens later. Right before the chase.
Yes. Yeah. I was like, Annie... Annie, are you okay? Are you okay, Annie? It's like, of course. it was very good. Also, what does the parrot from Aladdin have to do with this? Give me laugh Iago. Out loud. Iago. Oh, so good.
So silly.
I remember these wind machines.
Yeah, we couldn't afford rain. It was scripted. It was scripted. It was pouring rain. And so the compromise was, well, what if we just blow the hell out of everybody?
And a question for the director, side note, going back to the Victoria scene, her exit, there's a song that plays over her exit.
We're getting to it. We're not there yet.
Okay.
Because that's who I want to shout out to, because it's like...
Proceed.
I knew I wanted to use a 90-degree shutter at some point on the camera.
A 90-degree shutter.
Okay. Yeah. And it's just something that picks up light in a slightly different way and gives texture to a shot, without having to do any tricks or special effects. And I was going to do it in this chase scene because there was going to be raindrops and we were going to light through the rain and the shutter would pick up the raindrops and that would look really dope. And then when it turned into wind, I thought, oh, well, that's not going to work anymore. And I remember Mike McMurray saying, well, let's just throw it on there anyway. It's not going to cost us anything.
Mike McMurray. Mike
McMurray, who was so awesome during this, by the way. I mean, I remember the first 3 or 4 days I made him get up and have breakfast with me just so that we could go over our shot list. Because I was obsessing over, being over prepared. But what ended up happening was these wind machines kicked up all these leaves. So there's actually leaves blowing and the lights catching the leaves. So the shutter still ended up serving a purpose. And I was still pretty pleased that we got some value out of that.
I also
want to shout out thanks to the 90 degree shutter that you stole from Spielberg in Saving Private Ryan.
Yeah.
That he also stole because he wasn't the first person to do it.
Right. I want to also shout out another that circular shot that I know you're talking about is kind of like a default cool thing to do for like a first time director. But I will say the other one that really works is the end of Bueller, and Michael directed that. Right? Is in the gym.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. Anyway, it reminded me of that. Sean trips and falls, but the sack face mystery man doesn't kill him because it's actually Jason. It is also revealed that Gus, Annie, and Billy were all in on the plan. Jason mentions he wants to open a murder mystery camp. Still a good idea. Just as a storm approaches, the whole gang gathers inside for a party when Sean discovers the body of the camp's janitor floating in the lake. Great song, Paranoia. Paranoia, whatever that song is called. Paranoia, Paranoia. Anyway, yeah.
So have we jumped to, there's a line reading you give, James, of the Mr. Cunningham. Bravo. I know I've heard that reading somewhere in the 80s. I just don't know who did it.
Most of that entire section is lifted, again, shamelessly and unapologetically from a movie called April Fool's Day, which was one of my very favorite and underrated slasher offerings, because it was way before Scream. But it was the first one that I thought effectively combined the elements of slasher and comedy, and not bad comedy, but actually relatively effective comedy. It was actually written by the same guy that wrote Beverly Hills Cop. And they got a really good cast of young actors who all kind of went on to do interesting stuff together to make this movie, because you find out, spoiler alert, it's not actually a slasher film. You think you're watching a slasher film the whole time. And then the big reveal at the end of that movie is that nobody's dead, and that Muffy is inherited this house from her parents who have passed. And the only way she thinks she might be able to afford it and keep up the mortgage is by turning it into a weekend murder mystery experience. And she needed a rehearsal. So she invited a bunch of her friends from college who had no idea what was about to happen to them. And that's exactly what Jason is going to do with this camp.
Do they exist? I feel like these must exist, no?
I know that there are like nights people do like murder mystery parties.
Parlor games. Yeah, totally. Right.
I mean, like everyone has a character that they're supposed to play. But
right.
But this was interesting because nobody knows, like, I mean, they in April Fool's Day, they don't know that they're a part of anything like that. So they're genuinely terrified.
Right.
Your slow clap when it's revealed that Jason Cunningham is the bad guy, and your bravo, Mr. Cunningham, is not, you don't remember that being an actual lift from another actor saying the word bravo?
I think bravo is from April Fool's Day. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good. You're like so angry, but also kind of impressed. And like, it's a very complicated bravo.
Yeah.
You're clapping your hands
Judd
very hard.
It felt a little Judd me from something.
It's really good. You guys, I absolutely love Butcher Box. It is so hard, I think, to find, you know, the free range without antibiotics, hormones, humanely raised, all of that. And I love that they incorporate all of that into their meat and their seafood. ButcherBox takes the guesswork out of finding high quality meat and seafood you can trust. You get 100% grass-fed beef, free-range organic chicken, pork raised crate-free, and wild-caught seafood. Humanely raised. You guys know how important that is to me. No antibiotics or added hormones. Plus, it's the ultimate convenience. Get just what you want delivered right to your doorstep. Free shipping for the continental U.S. and no surprise fees. Choose from a variety of box plan options from curated to customized, and change your plan whenever you want. Enjoy a range of high-quality cuts that are hard to come by at the grocery store at an amazing value. Exclusive member deals so you can save big on your favorite cuts. Recipe inspiration, guides, tips, and hacks. Some are even personalized, so you can cook up those mouth-watering meals. I actually just used some of the meat from my butcher box to make a very fun chili. My family has like several recipes in this recipe book, and I want to add my own, so I'm doing my own take on it, and I was so happy to use this humanely raised, grass-fed beef. It's also so good. The main course for Thanksgiving dinner can sometimes be a main source of stress, but not anymore. ButcherBox is offering our listeners free turkey with their first order. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/pineapple and use code pineapple to get one 10 to 14 pound turkey free in your first box. That's huge, you guys. Huge. That's butcherbox.com/pineapple and use code pineapple to claim this deal.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Okay. Just as a storm approaches, the whole gang gathers inside. We already did this. Okay. The song, I Am Sulking, which is hilarious.
Flagpole Sitta. Parentheses, paranoia.
Paranoia. Okay.
By Harvey Danger. That song sort of had its moment because it was in a movie called Disturbing Behavior. Featuring a young Katie Holmes.
Katie Holmes, who was,
I think, maybe doing her first or second movie coming out of her Dawson's popularity.
Yeah. Okay, Juliet tries to phone an ambulance, but soon learns that all phone lines have been knocked out, preventing her from getting a signal, and all the roads have been completely blocked by fallen trees from the oncoming lightning storm. A while later, Annie decides to go back to her cabin to take a shower, and Clive leaves the group as well. After getting out of the shower, Annie notices a man with a potato sack over his head carrying an axe standing behind her, whom she mistakes for Jason, and is murdered off screen. This I had several times where I went, ooh, ew. genuinely scary. All right.
Yeah, and I also remember the ambulance piece where the counselors are all standing in front of the cabin, watching, I don't know, the old dude get loaded up or something. It's basically the poster of Friday the 13th. Like, they're all in the exact positions of the counselors from the movie.
Insane.
Yeah.
So insane. It's so cool.
This is
cool.
A deep dive.
This is so cool.
Get up in there dive.
Okay, now we're here. So back at Lassie's dinner, he decides to sign the papers and end the night with a solemn kiss. Like, actual tears from me rewatching this.
Back to show first. This is really the first time that Lassiter ever got to be this kind of vulnerable.
Oh, yeah. 100%.
And you're so, Tim, look, and Justine, obviously great. But, like, you in these scenes, this whole story, the whole arc of it from where you start with the flowers and the excitement to the necklace to realizing what's happening to coming around to this like beautiful, mature, like loving take. It was just a beautiful goodbye between two people who really loved each other. Like, it's a very, I don't know that you see things play out like that all the time. And you're so good in the scene. It's shot so beautifully. And then you can talk about the song if you want, Tim, because I was going to shut up.
In addition to the writing the words I got to say, I knew I had James there to not let me fall and make a fool of myself. So it's truly because James was there helping me.
I did not have to do much. And I knew I wouldn't. I just needed to make sure that the camera had your face on it, which it did.
I feel like you brought out performances from everybody that were a notch up. All of us, I felt like, moved. All of our characters had a move forward in this.
Yeah, I think for Lassiter, he had sort of arrested his own development because of the fact that he was in this holding pattern with with his wife, and I think he'd kind of been stuck for a while. And one way or the other, you know, this was going to get him unstuck.
Yeah.
And so there was an evolution from like, hey, I'm going to get back with Victoria, and that's what's going to drag me out of this hole and allow me to feel like more of a whole person.
Yeah.
And then realizing in the moment that, nope, it's not going to be that, but I'm going to let her go, and that's what's going to drag me out of this hole. So there's a lot going on there. And you played every beat of it. And I think specifically talks about
so we can both have tomorrows.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And without this scene, we would never have gotten Lazarus to take the chance of somebody with somebody like Marlowe years
Absolutely.
Later.
Absolutely.
And it was also the cumulative effect that Juliet had on Lasseter as well, that all sort of led us to this moment.
Yeah. And 100%. And one would argue the same, as I'm taking on this sort of tougher cop role and I'm in charge and I'm confident in it. I really believe that also comes from Lasseter as well. It's a two, we've had quite an influence on each other, and it's nice to see that played out in scenarios where we're not even in the same scene and we're not calling it out. But we are, you know, you would have been so proud of me that day.
I would have. No, but definitely like the presence in each other's lives and what we've done to each other's personalities is so evident, as James so eloquently stated.
And then there's a song that by a friend of ours, Priscilla Ahn.
Oh, that's Priscilla's, of course.
The voice of an angel, and just a wonderful human being. And James,
Dear friend of the Syke family, wife to Michael Weston, another dear friend of the Syke family, recording artist, mother all around, badass. And I knew that I was going to use that song for that moment before we even started writing. That was on lock.
Amazing.
It's called.
It makes me cry right now.
It's called A Good Day. I thought it was perfect for the scene, perfect for the moment. The lyric is heartbreakingly spot on, and aspirational. And ultimately, even though it's a very sad scene, we also wanted to sort of say, hey, you know, Lasseter's gonna be okay.
Just give me chills when you said A Good Day is the title of that name of that song.
Me too. Yeah. It's so special. It's just that moment is so special. That's one of my favorite things about the way you direct too, with music. Like you often, I feel like I remember you saying things. I mean, you know, beforehand, I didn't remember this one. I knew Priscilla was gonna be used in the episode, but I feel like in Evening with Mr. Yang, I feel like when you directed that, we had like, you would play the music behind the scene half the time just for us to get into the emotion and the feel. And like, it's just a really cool musical way to get into scenes and characters, and like, because music can do that.
I think it helps. And I think it's okay. I think a lot of times, you know, music is obviously so intrinsic to what makes film work, but it can also be really manipulative. And you know, a lot of times you can bail yourself out by slapping a really good song over something. And a lot of times you can think that you really liked a movie, and then, you know, years later, watch it again and go, no, I just really love this soundtrack. That's how powerful a medium it can be. So for me, I always try to approach it in a way that's like, okay, this song does elicit emotion all on its own, but if I play it while we're shooting the scene, and you and Tim, for example, Yang is a perfect example.
Oh, which I was going to say, because you're not going to be with us when we're talking about Yang, Clock Tower was that you playing that song for us was so pivotal.
Well, that's end of next season. My plan is to Joms will be with us.
Talk about it again then. But the marriage of a really good song and the actors knowing that song is going to be there, so that they're actually making choices and feeling the song, as opposed to just, play this scene, I'm going to slap this great song on there later. I think you can earn the emotion of a scene by knowing what music you're going to use ahead of time. You don't always have that luxury, of course, but...
Do you remember, play Good Day for me prior to the scene? Because when I was watching the episode back, it really struck me as somewhere being in the back of my heart of like, I know this song.
I did. You put it. We put it in some headphones for you, and I think you were using it to sort of prepare. And I think it's really useful.
Yeah, that one's still that's still in my body somewhere.
Yeah.
Magic. She's so magical too, Priscilla.
She's I've used many of her songs in many things.
So y'all go check out Priscilla On, yo.
Yeah, Priscilla On. That's that right. Song. Okay. Meanwhile, Sean decides to have another look at the dead janitor's body after suspecting that there might be a little bit more to this case than he'd originally expected. And just like that, the power is cut throughout the camp and Billy leaves to try to fix it. But he ends up being electrocuted by the killer, causing the power to come back on. Sean finally figures out that Clive is the killer and he and Juliet go out to investigate, later finding the bodies of Annie and Billy. I loved all the running. Wait, there was one thing I wanted to say. I have running in the sound machines. That's one of my favorites. But weird nipples when yeah. Clive says, I got weird nipples. Also, Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkov. There was like also, I'm not sure if we're here yet, but the Jeff Goldblum and Cyndi Lauper vibes line had me also in stitches. Anyway, I loved this discovery of Annie, the discovery of Billy, the putting together of the whole thing. And isn't there like a, you have this crazy Sean vision that is shot so cool. And the music is like really that.
Oh, during the champagne scene, right?
This was the first thing we did that we had never done before, which was somewhat controversial, I remember, was Sean has a Sean vision flashback while he's being chased Jason before the jig is up,
right?
And we did it in a way we had never done before, and we also used sound effects from the Texas Chainsaw Massacre reboot, which is that very unsettling, almost like Polaroid camera happening. And we stylized the Sean Vision flashback in a way that we had never done before. There was some nerves coming from, you know, from network and studio. Like, can we do this? Like, it's so different. Mm-hmm. And we decided that yes, we could, because it was steeped so specifically in the theme of the episode that, you know, it's not like we're changing Sean Vision's forever. We're just doing a slasher-esque one for this. But I remember some very serious discussions had to take place.
And then there's a shot though where you move with the camera, not running, but you're like the camera. I feel like you were on. Yeah. What was
myself,
that?
I put myself on the dolly. Yet again, another first time director wanting to show off how many movies they've seen. That is the Spike Lee dolly shot that he has made famous in all of his movies, where you basically sit an actor on the dolly facing the camera. And then when you start moving around, it creates an effect that you're almost like floating in space.
Very cool. It was very cool.
Steal from the vest.
Exactly.
That's right.
Back at the main cabin, Gus, Sissy, and Jason are interrupted by a mysterious sound. Just then, Clive appears from around the corner and charges at the trio, but Jason risks his life to protect Gus and Sissy. Sissy runs after Sean and tells him that the killer was in the cabin and points over to Gus fighting with him in the pool. Sean rushes to save him, thinking Gus has lost, but it turns out he already won. Sean and Clive fight to the death until Juliet comes to the rescue. Also, I just have to like... the noodle, the broom, the amount of things that he throws at you. Oh, it's again, it manages to be very scary and very funny at the same time. I was laughing out loud.
We also managed to pay off the creepy Robert the doll that Jason is dragging around with him, which is based on a real doll named Robert. And then we throw a wig on him so that you think that Clive's been sitting on the couch playing video games the whole night.
So good. So good. And yes, a very good payoff to the very, very creepy doll. Also, this pool that we had seen a few times, like we're now in it, basically. Yeah. And you had like, it was in the deep end and we filled it, right? You filled the pool.
So that we could have a water fight. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, yeah, it was really neat. That was cool. I actually feel like it was raining that night.
It might have been. Yeah. And then you showed up and blew a hole through his hand, right?
Correct. No, we're not there yet. Yeah. So
right. The most badass O'Hara's that we've gotten to see yet.
It's okay. This might be the coolest I've ever felt in anything in my life. I am the whole episode though. I just like the running sequences, the way that it's shot. It's dark. You know, he's got the wind blowing all the time. And I was watching it and I was like, I look really cool in this. Look very cool. And then,
even though you're in your dad's suit, you still managed to look badass and cool.
Didn't even bother me. In fact, I thought it added to it in this one. I was still like, I was like, what is happening right now? I felt some crazy like Law and Order stuff. I was like action-y. And then I got to blow a hole through his hand. I got to shoot him. So hold on. Juliet comes to the rescue, shoots Clive in the hand, knocking the machete out of his grip.
Your line, James, of your... I can't remember exactly what it was. Like, you're dead. Like, you're dead on marksmanship.
Oh, yeah.
Turned me out so much right now.
Spot on.
That's
hilarious.
Really spot on, Juliet. I can't thank you enough. This was, it felt like camp. This whole episode really felt like it had that, which I think you said, like, that was your intention even from the beginning, yeah. Was like having all of us in one place. We were shooting out in, it was Squamish, right? Or like,
yeah, it was out there.
It was, but there was something about the whole thing. I have like some old photos and stuff from this experience too, that was just like, we were away. It was a camp. It was
I remember you took some great photos, of me sort of in action or thinking about something or looking at my script. I remember those photos. And then of course you had everybody sign a script for me.
Oh, that's right.
And had it bound. And it was such a lovely gift.
That's right.
So much so that I have done it for others.
Oh my God.
I have passed along that tradition and paid it forward because it's such a wonderful
way. It was such a huge dream that you made happen that I felt like, you know, I think on this show from the beginning, everyone, you were just saying how everyone really showed up, but like you showed up for everybody every day. You supported people, you supported crew members, you fought for people, you fought for, you know, the show to, you know, expand and in ways that like, you know, you were just there every single day. So we all saw this generosity and care. And so it was like, I remember even at the time thinking like, how do we thank you? How does this, because you, especially this was like your, I don't know. I feel like there's a first time director feeling that just wasn't here. It was like, we were in the safest hand. We were with you. Like it was the whole thing was magic start to finish. And you were so open and kind and having conversations with everybody about what we wanted and what was happening. Anyway, I thought it was an opportunity.
So that incredibly difficult thing of your first time directing yourself. I don't know how you did this.
Yeah.
You didn't feel that. Yeah.
I have learned over the years to truly not care for that. the having to step in front of the camera and like, craft performance of any kind while also wanting to watch every second and make sure that it's all coming together the way that you want it to. So starting with the episodes I directed on Psych, if you sort of track it, you know, Sean becomes less present with each subsequent episode.
That's true.
Towards the end, I mean, I was the lightest I ever was in
which selfishly you always gave me great stuff to do in those episodes.
I mean, look, we figured out a way to get Sean out of like an entire sequence in the Shining episode, which was,
oh my God,
which was so good.
Oh God, that's right.
It should have been that from the beginning. But yeah, I want to say that it was supposed to be Sean that you were chasing, and I was just like, no way, not doing that. And of course, it needed of course it needed to be Gus. I can't even imagine that scene any other way.
Yeah. Yeah, no. I do remember even Bonnie Hammer. Even Bonnie Hammer wanted to sign that for you. I remember I was nervous. I really hadn't had that many conversations.
For context, she was at the time president of USA. Yes.
Yes, yeah. Yes. It was like intimidating, but it wasn't because it was asking for you. She was like, oh my God, yes, of course, I'll do anything. Anyway, everyone loved you. And I wanted, I just wanted you to have a token to like walk away and have everyone get their opportunity to say
thank you. Well, it was a wonderful token and I'll never forget it. And thank you so much for being so thoughtful. And that was a real good time. That was a really good time.
We still have another scene. Hold on. The next morning, paramedics and ambulances arrive and take Jason and Sissy to the hospital where Gus learns that the two were actually engaged. Womp, womp.
Poor Gus.
The episode concludes with Sean, Juliet, and Gus standing by the water, staring out onto the lake, relieved that this horrible weekend is over. Gus also apologizes to Sean for ditching him for Jason 20 years ago. Sean accepts. This shot is so cool.
Yeah, and it sort of leaned into slasher movie lore of just, you know, always presenting this bucolic setting.
Yeah.
You know, nature at its best, and then, you know, having
a little dash of Lake Placid.
And then just having the most awful things you can imagine happen surrounded by beauty.
Yeah.
And that was sort of the intent of that final scene. But also, I specifically remember us wanting the ending to feel a little more grounded than usual because of the fact that the deaths in Tuesday the 17th are pretty awful. Like they're pretty brutal.
Yeah.
And that's not usually that's not usually what we did on our show. So it felt like there needed to be some acknowledgement that we did that at the end of the episode, which is why nobody's making jokes or cracking up. And it's just the three of us sort of having been through this night of peril and acknowledging like that was rough.
Yeah, it was intense. It was intense.
I kind of actually love that Lasseter wasn't involved with any of the police work in this. I love that it was all O'Hara.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was fun.
Yeah, Lassie was doing a different kind of heavy lifting that night.
Emotional.
Mm-hmm.
The hardest kind.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Okay. Oh, here's some fan questions. Joms, was it really storming during the pool fight scene?
You have a better memory than I do. So I think we couldn't afford rain machines, that's for sure. So if it was raining, that was good old Vancouver giving us the good stuff.
I think it was because I remember it became like really important to get the shot. There were a couple of shots because of my hair. I think we could get away with you guys a little bit more, but I do remember there being a thing of like matching my hair and the rain on my
raindrops
jacket,
on
like
your
all
suit.
That.
That all feels very familiar now. Yeah,
I think it was. Okay, for James, is it difficult to direct and act at the same time?
I think it is. I mean, everybody's different. I mean, there are plenty of actors who direct themselves constantly and to great success. It's not for me. I really do feel like for me, there's no way to give 100% in both. I just feel like something always gets a little bit lost. Probably the acting for me, which is why I tend to try to stay out of my own way.
Well, it was not noticeable in this. For Maggie and Tim, what was it like having James as your director?
Blissful is a word I would use.
I don't know if it gets better. I really do think I've done things I even doubted I could do. Greedy, for example, or, you know, that you have a way of really believing in your people too. Like, not just like, hey, here's a note, let me try and like get this performance. It's like you have this in, like, you make it about like you find it on your own, you get there on your own. So that, anyway, I can't say enough about it. Every actor should be so lucky to get to work with a director like James.
Because we were so lucky to know each other, like James, I feel like you and I always had a shorthand when we were on set together.
100%. And that was a key to this first experience going as smoothly as it did. Because we were essentially we were all directing each other for 3 years anyway.
Yeah. Where did the name Tiki Hama come from?
100% Steve Franks. He always knew that's what he wanted the camp to be called. I don't know if next time you have him on, you'll have to ask him. I don't know if it was something from his childhood or his kids' childhood, but he wanted Tiki Hama, and then he also came up with the Tiki Hama camp song.
Oh, I was going to ask about that. It's so creepy and so good. It's, yes. I think he mentioned that in another podcast as well.
Yeah.
Okay, where did you shoot the camp scenes?
A true camp that's no longer exists up near Squamish.
Beautiful. Did any of you go to camp and got any fun camp stories?
I went to one camp. It was in high school, and it was a theater camp at a college. So it was not a traditional camp experience where you did campy type things. We just went and took classes and ended up putting on a very, very bad David Mamet play.
Which one?
Yeah.
We did The Water Engine.
Obscure, but awesome.
Obscure, but yeah. Not one of his less produced works, to be sure.
I don't really have a camp story because I didn't really go to that kind of a camp. Same. I had like dance camp and like theater camp, but I have one very vivid memory of my older brother going to camp at Camp Tall Trees, somewhere outside of Kentucky, at Louisville, Kentucky. And all I remember was that I sobbed and I held on to him and I was like, he cannot go. Who am I going to play kickball with?
Aww.
And that story has been told many times since. I was distraught. Like, he was never coming back from camp.
That is adorable.
Who's going to roll the ball so I can kick it? Anyway, Tim.
I knew this question was going to be asked. And I wasn't a camp going kid. I would have loved it. Other than like, I went to Boy Scout camp one summer, but nothing like, nothing sort of out bunking it up, doing archery and making lanyards, unfortunately, because I would have loved that.
You were a great Boy Scout, though. I just feel like you would be an amazing Boy Scout.
I was an okay Boy Scout. I mean, I've told the story of my one-match fire here on the podcast before.
Oh, you have. Yeah.
So I could set up a great wood chopping circle.
Yeah.
I was good with an axe.
Oh.
But in terms of following on with like the hierarchy of Boy Scouts, wasn't really my thing. I kind of bailed a little early. I think I made it just past tenderfoot.
Well, it's not surprising that you're good with an axe because your sword game is strong.
Oh, and scene. Wow. Oh, Joms, you missed last week with Dulay, which won't surprise you at all. We went on a whole run because it was the episode.
Oh, my God. It was so good.
Oh, my God. The golf ball. Oh, my God. What was last week's episode, Tim? Not Any Given Sunday. The one after that. Through a Lies. Thank you, Devin. And there's the whole golf ball bit at the very beginning, and there's no actual ball. He let us know there was no actual ball at the beginning as you guys are reacting to it.
So the phrase "no balls" was used quite a bit in that episode. How James Dulay worked with no balls.
They acted with no balls. And then it was a whole runner of like, well, it's because you're so good at knowing how to act with balls that when they're not there, you can still act without them. Devin, we might have to cut this.
I gotta say, Mags, in that conversation, you were the one who coined the phrase "no balls." It was not Dulay.
No, but Dulay is like, pun intended, he'll throw a softball and he knows I'm going to pick it up.
Yes,
or he knows I'm going to hit it. So he has this way of making.
You curated the bit and you landed it. Yeah.
Yeah. He can. He has a very funny. I know where he's going sometimes. And so
you smashed it out
of
the park.
I like to follow him. Yeah.
True or Lies, was that the one with Johnny?
Yes.
Yes.
He is so good.
And Martha Coolidge directed that.
And guess who we have? Martha Coolidge directed that, right? We have Jimmy for Yang.
An evening. That's good.
No,
stuff.
For next week. For
the first one.
Oh yeah, the first one. Right.
Yang won.
Yang won.
Yeah. We'll have to get I have to get Allie on for one of them too.
We were just talking about that. Like, we'll have Jimmy and then Allie next time around. And then maybe we'll like have in some of these that are like, you know, we're getting into it now. Yeah. Like, there's just like, I mean, we always had great guest stars, but like director, guest star, we might have more than one guest sometimes, or like it'd be really fun to have you and Allie. Yeah. So, because the Yangs have to be like, I'm so glad we have Jimmy for this one, but we have to talk to you about where all this came from too. Yeah. Like, we were talking about this today. It started playing because on Peacock, when you're watching the episodes back, the next one will start playing, and Yang started playing. And I'm like, oh, I mean, this is when Psych was just, we were rolling. We were rolling by now. Anyway, Joms, thank you.
Always. Always a pleasure. It was such a, this was such a wonderful experience that I will never forget. Anytime anyone for the rest of my life asks me how I got my start directing, it'll always be this story with these people. And
yeah,
it'll take me back to a very, very happy place in my life. So,
James, will you text me your address? Because I'm going to get on a plane and fly to Vancouver so I can crawl on the bed and spoon that dog right now.
Yeah.
I thought you were like going to spoon him. I just that's was getting emotional.
That's also in play. That's in play. That he's a top flight cuddler though. He is.
Oh, God,
you can tell.
So magical.
Yeah.
I think there's a cloud sandwich in my future.
Yeah. He will purr and make you feel so special.
This was so fun to talk to you about, and we're going to bug you for more. So.
It is always such a pleasure to hang with you two. Keep kicking ass and podcasting the shit out of things.
Yeah.
And have fun with Jimmy Simpson.
We will. And you too. How you directed the shit out of this.
This was such a special episode to me for so many reasons, all the reasons we got into. But to have my sort of acting game lifted by you for the gifts you gave me as a writer and a director, and Steve Franks for that goodbye speech and tomorrow's speech. So I just want to thank you again for being an amazing friend and such a dear part of my life.
I am the winner. I am the winner here.
Seriously, such an incredible episode. I love having James on the pod. It's really, really special for all of us. And hearing him talk about this first time directing was very meaningful. It was very an emotional time. And the beginning of now we've gone on to see how much he's done. And it's kind of amazing that we were all together for the first one. Anyway, as always, thank you guys for listening to episode 15 of The Psychologists Are In. Don't forget to follow us on our Instagram at The Psychologists Are In and our Twitter at Psychologist Pod. And now check out our Patreon for full videos of the episodes and more at patreon.com/psychologistsarein.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.